Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit Simplecast.com. Recorded live from the lobby of the Lion Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C.
You're listening to the D.C. Public Library on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Lion Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I am your host, Olubunmi Bakari. This is our All Things Local series, where we highlight the local history, culture, communities, and persons who have made an impact on Washington, D.C. and the world. My guest today is Paul Coates. Paul Coates is the owner and operator of Black Classic Press and Black Classic Press Digital, which is based in Baltimore, Maryland. Black Classic Press is one of the few Black publishing companies in the United States. Paul, thank you for joining me.
Hi, Bumi. Glad to be with you.
Thank you. You're joining me by phone today. We had a conflict, so we're working it out anyway. Should I call you Paul or Mr. Coates?
I think I'm okay simply as Paul, since that's what most people call me.
Okay.
That'd be great. Okay.
Paul. Well, welcome to DCPL Radio. Now, before we begin talking about Black Classic Press, I want to talk a little bit about your background and your early life. Now, you're from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, correct?
Correct.
What stands out to you in your earlier formative years that influenced where you would go in the future? Is there anything from your childhood that you can share with me?
You know, if you put it in context of where I would go in the future, I immediately go back to libraries.
Okay.
I immediately go back to libraries. I always consider myself a person of books.
Mm-hmm.
And that books and literature, the reading, it's probably been one of the strongest influences in my life. I remember back as a youngster when the group of guys that I hung around with, when we would hooky school, when we would play hooky, we would oftentimes just not end up in the library, hiding out in the library, reading books in the library. And particularly the main library in Philadelphia,
mm-hmm.
which is still a beautiful, beautiful edifice.
Mm-hmm.
I think about libraries as, and bookstores to an extent also, as being cathedrals to me.
Mm-hmm. And
I got
reading?
That as a young person.
Okay.
I was reading mostly white books and anything,
mm-hmm.
you know, anything. In Philadelphia at 17th and Montgomery, there was an old collection there that had a museum attached to it. I remember we used to go there and we would read children's books, just books that were available. But it was also in that library at 17th and Montgomery that I got my very, very first black book.
Mm-hmm.
It had black characters in it. Later, it would be made into a movie called The Buffalo Soldiers.
Hmm. Okay.
With the movie starred Woody Strode, but the book was probably the very first black book that I read, as I can recall it, and it came from that library. So libraries were very, very important to me as a young person. They were important. You know, Bumi, this is a side note. When, as I grew up and I eventually spent time in the Black Panther Party,
mm-hmm.
one of the things that I don't share often is that when I left the Panther Party, I had literally bus fare in my pocket.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't. I was going to go to a friend's house, and I ended up going over there. But that friend had moved, and I didn't have any place to go. What occurred to me to do was get on a bus again and ride. And it just so happened that the bus I got on, after a short time, it had me downtown, and it passed the Oakland Public Library. As soon as I passed that library, I knew what I was going to do. I got off the bus, I walked back one or two blocks, went in the library, and I camped out in the library to clear my head and to figure out what my next steps were going to be. So that is to say that libraries, and I know this wasn't the initial question you asked, but libraries served as a touchstone to me when I was younger. When I was very young, they served as a touchstone at different places in my life. And as you might already know from my bio, I eventually would go to library school and work in the library.
Let's build up to that before we touch on that, because there were a lot of things before that that led you to go to library school. So let's jump ahead a bit. So I also read that you went to Vietnam. You were a teenager when you went. And during your experience in the Army, you came across a book that you said changed your life. And that was Richard Wright's Black Boy. So talk about, you know, the experience that led you to picking that book up.
So as I said, my first experience with Black books was probably Buffalo Soldiers. And I had read a couple of other books after Buffalo Soldiers. I certainly had read James Baldwin. But it was when I went into the service, and as you said, I've never expressed it that I was a teenager. Hearing you say that, I had to think back on it. Yeah, that's right, I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. I was 17 years old, you know? And so anyway, there was a conflict between me and a Native American guy. And out of that, it was a racial conflict where he was calling me names and things like that. Out of that conflict, I ended up taking some chill time and going to what we have in the military called day rooms. And those are recreation rooms. And I discovered in the day room a book called Black Boy that I thought was part of a conspiracy plot by these white guys. I really thought that I was going to be attacked, and they had done something with this book, because no one called anybody black when I was growing up. You know, that was a term that you fought over. Somebody called you black. And here's a book called Black, where I picked it up. I saw it was by Richard Wright. I read a few pages, and I knew it was legitimate. I took it back to my room. And reading Black Boy and remembering Baldwin, remembering the Buffalo Soldiers, just told me there was a whole genre of black books that I had been missing out on. So I refocused my reading after reading Black Boy, and it did. It changed my life. It gave me a direction and made me even more committed to books and literature, but with a focus on black people.
Okay. And then so you did your time in Vietnam, and then when you came home to the U.S., you settled in Baltimore. What was it that brought you to Baltimore?
I moved to Baltimore. I actually came back to Philadelphia.
Okay.
And then moved to Baltimore to get married, actually.
Okay.
So I met a young lady, and we got married and began having children. I took a job in Baltimore training dogs, because that's what I had done in the military.
And I also read that you initially were afraid of dogs, correct? And
then, became
a dog handler in the military.
That's correct. Because I had been jumped by a Great Dane when I was very small, and I had this fear of dogs.
And the dog just licked you, right? It didn't.
Yeah, he just licked me. The Great Dane just licked me, but he was big enough to knock me down, you know, and be over top of me licking me. Yeah, so he was quite a size. But that fear, I don't know if I ever got rid of that fear handling dogs, because what happens with canines, and these are German Shepherd dogs, and they ranged anywhere, the females range anywhere from 70 pounds to the males, they go up to 120 pounds. So you're talking about big animals. It's just that what you end up doing is form an alliance with your dog, and mm-hmm. you form a bond with your dog. And so I never really feared my dog, but there were a couple of times that I came close to getting chewed up by other dogs that weren't mine, you know?
Interesting. And so in Baltimore, that is where you got involved in the Black Panthers.
That is correct.
You would eventually become the captain of the entire state of Maryland. So talk about your experience in the Panthers in Baltimore.
So the Black Panther Party was founded by Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale in Oakland, California, 1966. It quickly spread across the country, because all across the country you had people who could align with the Panthers and fight against issues like police brutality, fight against issues like incarceration that was going on in our community, the fact that we had few institutions that represented our interests. Our vote was often compromised. Our housing was compromised. And so these were general issues that the Panthers addressed in Oakland, and they had a 10-point platform and program that they put out, and people in different areas could align with it. Mm-hmm. And at this point, many people, including myself, felt that some other response to white racism, other than sitting down and being attacked by dogs or being shot with water hoses, was a more appropriate response. The Panthers armed themselves, and they encouraged everyone to arm themselves and prepare for a day of conflict against the forces, as we saw them, the forces of oppression and repression in this country. So the interesting thing about it, even though the Panthers had a policy of armed resistance, most of the things we did in the community, a matter of fact, I don't remember one thing we did in the community that required us to go armed. Mm-hmm. We created programs like the free breakfast program, clothing programs, medical programs to help improve the healthcare needs of our community, jail programs, which helped get families back and forth to jail. We created educational programs. These are programs that we saw as pointing out contradictions in society, but also actually delivering help in our community so that the community would recognize that we were there for service and not as a threat against the community. And by and large, those programs operated all over the country as well as in Baltimore.
Yeah. And I took a look at you have an FBI file, which I was like, it's cool.
You got an FBI file too, Boomy. Trust me. Trust me.
Okay.
Yeah. If you work with information, and I try to point this out to people. Mm-hmm. You see, anytime you're working with information, and anytime you're working with people and their minds, the way that people think, mm-hmm. you represent a threat to the existing status quo. The status quo wants to know early on who you are. And so they begin drawing up and doing investigations on people that you can't even begin to imagine they would have files on. Mm-hmm. But they do that early on so that they can keep a count on anyone that even looks like they're a threat. Mm-hmm. George Jackson used to talk about the threat to fascism and this country, mm-hmm. not the actual power of being able to deliver a death blow. They responded to the threat. Mm-hmm. I would not be surprised at all, Boomy. I would bet that you have a file.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's not a surprise that I would have a file. We were in an organization
right.
that advocated the overthrow of the government.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this government, you know, the current keeping of files goes back a little before Marcus Garvey's time. Mm-hmm. But Marcus Garvey certainly was captured in the information collection that the FBI, or what became the FBI, would do. You know, so were all the communist groups and social activist groups and Pan-African groups, all of them. So that would have been true in my case as well, Boone.
Well, what? Okay, but what I wanted to say, what was in the file, you know, specifically, just spoke about that you weren't really a direct threat, but that you were doing things in the community to help people, and to help prisoners who had been neglected by the Panthers. And specifically, you guys would do like crab feasts, and you also started the George Jackson prison movement. So talk a little bit about that, because that was kind of the precursor to Black Classic Press.
Yeah, and I just want to be clear. I would never say we weren't a threat, okay? We were perceived as a threat. If you're perceived as a threat, you are a threat. And so it's the perception. Like, so if you're talking about organizing prison programs, which we did, and if you're talking about dealing with people who are in jail and educating those people, then that's perceived as a threat against a prison operation that has to have people think one way, you see? So you're perceived as a threat there, and as far as they're concerned, you are a threat. Even if you're holding crab feasts in the community in which you're collecting money to buy books to carry into the jails. You know, they want to look at every book that comes in. And some of those books, in the process of looking, they're going to determine those books as threatening also, which is going to go back to mean that you're a threat. You're somebody that must be watched. You see, because you have an influential voice in the jail that they want to have in the jail. So our engagement with the jail was because we recognized that when I left the Black Panther Party, I still wanted to be engaged in the business of transforming my community. And where would you go to find the most viable population to be transformed? Well, in the Black community, you've got tremendous brain power locked up in the jails. You talk about transformation. Malcolm had already presented an example of how someone could go to jail and be transformed. George Jackson had done the same thing. We were excited by that, and I was excited by that. And so, and because of the fact that I had recent charges probably taken off me, and I still had friends and Panthers who were in jail, we developed a prison program that could support work inside the jail at transformation and support work outside the jail at transformation. Transformation that would be accomplished through reading of books. I'm sure you're familiar with the quote that books change people and people change the world. That was very, very clear, and it became very clear to me after I left the Panthers that we weren't going to win against the forces of repression by shooting it out with bullets. I adopted books for my bullets. And my effort was an effort of, you know, using those bullets in the mind, affecting people in the mind. So the fact that they perceived me as a threat, I feel I was. I was just a different, I wasn't the threat they were looking at beating, you know? I just wasn't. The George Jackson, I think you with the George Jackson prison movement, did that cover that for you?
I'm still thinking about you saying that I have a file. But okay.
And it's a good, Boomi, it's a good way of thinking, because most people think that they don't. And it's just not true. And I could, out of the FBI files that have been uncovered recently for me, one of the things I see is that not only are they watching me, they're watching everybody that comes around me. So everybody that came around me also had a file. You see, everybody that I went around and had a file, I got, you know, something got put in my file. You know, Boomi, at that time, and it's probably not that much different now. Do you know, at one point, each FBI agent had to have 15 informers working for him?
Wow.
15 informers. And then they upped that number. You can't even begin to imagine, if you've got field agents, let's say you've got 5 of them or 10 of them, okay? Think about it. That would give you 150 informers that are working in the black community of Baltimore.
Wow.
I don't even know how many agents they had, but just think about that. And you had to get reports from them. And some of them you had to get engaged in different things. There was one period in which, the Panther Party, there was a guy that was beaten, this was before my time, beaten and killed in the Panther Party. There were 6 informants engaged in that activity that encouraged it on. Those 6 would go from the beating and go outside and report to their various handlers, and they didn't know each other's handlers.
Mm.
Do you understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying there were 6 different agencies that had agents inside a little chapter like the Black Panther Party.
Mm.
Think about it. Stuff is real.
And on that note, I want to ask you about social movements today. And, you know, one of the things that I noticed about social movements, let's say in the 60s, the 70s, is, you know, how young the people were, how articulate you were, and how knowledgeable and engaged you were and they were. So what do you think about the social movements of today?
I am generally favorable and very appreciative of the social activists who are out there today, you know, trying to get things done in their way, trying to get things changed as they see things should be changed. Not necessarily how I see it, but as they see it, you know,
mm-hmm.
Because I think that's what's important. You have to work in an environment in which you want to make a change. You have to look at those things that you want to change and go forward. You can't operate on a vision that I may have had 45 or 50 years ago. You have to, if there's going to be any relationship between what was in the past and what's current now, cool. But that has to be revisioned and reshaped by you, not by somebody who was doing it like 40 or 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I still see young people today that are really kicking butt in their own way, and I'm generally pleased. I'm not one of those cats that jump back and say, well, the young people ain't doing this, they ain't doing that. I see mass action all over the place,
mm-hmm.
and mass engagement all over the place, and I'm very, very excited by it. The fact that I could be on the radio today and talk to a woman who has an African name who is much younger than me is progress, trust me, because we came along, we created names within that generation.
Mm-hmm.
No one had an African name unless they actually came from the continent. So this is progress. This is truly, truly a cultural advance.
Okay. And so after the Panthers, you went to college and eventually went to library school.
I did, Bumi. So this is much after the Panthers. I came out of the Panthers. I created the George Jackson Prison Movement to work in the prisons with that notion of setting up a bookstore, which I did, with the notion of setting up a publishing house, which I did before I went to library school. By that time, I had children who were coming along I was very concerned about, and I needed to do something that was more stable and income-producing than the community service prison programs I had set up.
Mm-hmm.
So going, finishing Sojourner Douglas College, which was a branch of Antioch, going to Atlanta University for library school became the plan, and it was a plan that I enacted on, and from there I ended up working at Howard University.
Mm. Yeah, and so what I was thinking, you know, when I was reading about this is that when one thinks of a librarian, you don't necessarily think of a Black Panther going to library school. So what was it? Why did you decide to go to library school?
Okay. So I was already publishing when I decided to go to library school. And, you know, I was publishing, I was selling books, and I was on Howard's campus one day. It was actually one of the maintenance guys that was so happy that his daughter was graduating from school. And we got to talk, and he was talking to me and another guy, and he was talking about how he had taken the job at Howard and how he had come up there and how he was sweeping up and cleaning up. And he did all of that so his daughter could have a free education. Well, the light bulbs went off in my head that I was doing Antioch at that point, which became Sojourner Douglas in Baltimore, and I was ready, close to graduating. And what was I going to do next? The light bulbs went off in my head that I could go away to graduate school, and the dream for me at that time was to come back and work at Moreland Spingarn. Oh, okay. And in order to do that, I needed a library degree.
Okay.
And so I picked the school that had the most tradition for Black folks that turned out librarians, and that was Atlanta University. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to go to that school, and that's what I eventually did. And I was fortunate to go and be nurtured by Black librarians that were just that were some of the most fierce learners that I'd ever encountered.
Dorothy Porter Wesley?
No, actually, Dorothy Porter Wesley was here at Howard by that. I mean, she was retiring, actually.
Oh, really?
Let me see. She had actually retired before I went to library school.
Oh, okay.
I knew her, and she was a great influence on me, yes. And I would know her later after I came back from library school, and she would influence me further. But at Atlanta, you had Virginia Lacey Jones, who actually was the second Black person, the second woman to graduate with a PhD in library science. I believe that's what it is.
Mm.
And she had founded the school at Atlanta University, the library school there, and had been there since 1940. So she was still there when I went there. And fortunately, she took me under her wings. There were other Black women that took me under their wings at Atlanta. They respected the fact that I was 33 years old. I had 5 children at the time. And they knew of my past with the Panthers. And they appreciated the work I was doing in publishing. My main mentor there was Penelope Bullock, who I can't even begin to tell you how much of an influence her presence and her acknowledgement and appreciation of me, how that heightened me in the world,
mm-hmm.
and how that made me larger in the world and more committed to the things that I was to do, because she acknowledged them. She acknowledged, and she was great. She was one of the greatest bibliophiles, bibliographers, one of the greatest Black bibliographers that ever lived. And she acknowledges me? Whew, boy. All of them did, and that's what made me so much more intent in my work, that I got acknowledgement from my elders.
Mm-hmm. And it was your work in the Moreland Spingarn Research Center that, would you say, got you interested in starting Black Classic Press?
No. Actually, I got interested in starting Black Classic Press as a part of the George Jackson Prison Movement. The focus on the books that we would publish, those books that were out of print,
mm-hmm.
actually came long before I went to library school. It came from the brothers who were in jail, who I would work with, and they would send this request out, and they'd look for books, and they'd be saying, man, can you help me find this book? The white man don't want Black people to read it, but I know it's out there. And as I searched the books out, what I found was that that the books, many of the books they wanted were out there. They were just obscure books. Mm-hmm. They had gone out of print because there really wasn't a market for them. And even though they were cornerstones, as far as I'm concerned, of African diasporic history, most people didn't know about them because they were out of print. They had been published 100 years ago, 50 years ago, all of this stuff. So I was hot on the trail of those books before I decided to go to library school, and I had begun publishing before I went to library school. And that's why the people who mentored me were so excited. Mm-hmm. So I came back to work at Moulin Spingarn, but I was already publishing, and I was successful there because Doc Ben used to say something. You know, he used to say, Dr. Joseph Dendro Cannon used to say, look, you know, like when you know something, you don't need a degree. You just need a degree to get paid. Mm-hmm. And that's what I had to have a degree in order to work in the Moulin Spingarn Research Center. But by the time I had come back, I had already mastered most of the books, most of those books in the collection I was intimate with, because I had traveled around the country to other collections and viewed the books, which is something I used to do. And again, that's why my elders were acknowledging me. That work was done before I went to Howard, and I continued to work at Howard, and that's what they acknowledged me for. And that's what I'm so grateful for even today. It gives me chills to think about being acknowledged by some of these, I mean, just great, great Black people. Dorothy Porter was tremendous. Penelope Bullock, these people, oh, God, I can't even tell you. No one will be able to fill their shoes. Mm-hmm. And they're acknowledging me. That's why it's so important for us to acknowledge young people as they come along now, I think. Mm-hmm. I know it's important for me to acknowledge them. It's important to strengthen them, to let them know that they're on the right path, to let them know that what they're doing is important to our struggle. All of that's really, really important and foundational to do.
And so what role do you think that librarians or libraries play in the fight for social justice, or do you think that they should play a role?
That's a tough question. I mean, because I don't think everyone should, because I don't think everyone should do, you know, any one thing, you know? Mm-hmm. I think if you see the need, whatever the need is, whether it's called social justice or whether it's called, you know, information studies, whatever it's called, I think if you see a role for yourself to make a difference in the world, to make the world a better place, then you need to do that. I don't care whether you're a librarian or construction worker. Mm-hmm. A librarian just has certain tools or access to tools when it comes to information that many other people do not have. And I think as such, if you're trying to change the world, your job becomes making sure people know those tools and making sure that people have access to those tools, and then creating other tools that will help people get the information they need to improve their lives. That is, if you have a commitment to move society forward, if you have a commitment to move humanity forward, then you can see a place for yourself, and you dig in and you do as much as you can do in the space of your existence. Mm-hmm. That's what I would think then.
Okay. I accept. So we're running low on time, but I do want to mention one of your recent releases, the Osiris Papers, Reflections on the Life and Writings of Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. Briefly share with our audience who Dr. Welsing was and why it was important for you to publish this book.
I hate to put it this way, but Dr. Welsing was a one-of-a-kind. At least as she came along, she was one of a kind, intellectual scholar who worked and practiced in the area of psychiatry. Mm-hmm. Her contribution, her large contribution that we're still trying to get our arms around and employ, was a tool for looking at and for comprehending white supremacy and white racism. She created the Kress theory of color confrontation as a theory to look at racism and to see it as a global system that oppressed black people. Now, we're still trying to, I'm saying those who she's left, she's one of the most important intellectual thinkers of the black experience, and those of us who are left are still trying to comprehend some of the things that she saw and some of the things that she understood. She died 4 years ago. She made her transition 4 years ago. And at that point, Ray Winborn, a couple other people got together and decided that they wanted to do a collection that focused on her work and her contributions. Now, out of that came the collection that we just published. There are 13 contributors, and they've looked at different aspects of Dr. Welsing's work as it is reflected in her theory. So she's looking at white racism, white supremacy, and she's looking at it, at how it engages, how we engage with that, and how white supremacy engages with black people in the different areas, whether there's love, economics, war, politics, sex, whatever it is, entertainment. We become in conflict with the forces of white supremacy, and it becomes important for them to dominate those areas. So the essays in this book is looking at how Frances viewed that and looking to extend that viewpoint out in the world so it could be better understood by people and better comprehended by people.
Wow. And there is a book signing coming up.
Oh yeah, I didn't know when you're airing. Actually,
we've
got a year. Oh gosh, hey live, hey folks. So we have a we have a book signing coming up at the Thurgood Marshall Center February the 3rd, and that's at 7. Mm-hmm. Also, Sankofa Books, which is in D.C. as well. We have a book signing and discussion there on February the 12th. We've actually initiated a year of discussions. So we're going to be moving around the country in different areas at different conferences. We want to talk about Frances Welsing. Mm-hmm. We want to talk about her impact on the black world and her impact on white supremacist thinking. And what it means today to us.
Well, thank you for your time. But before I let you go, I have 5 questions for you. I call it Fast Five.
5 questions before you let me go?
Yes. And you have to answer them quickly.
Oh, gosh. Okay, let's go.
Okay. What is your favorite book?
My favorite book probably is 2 favorite books, One of Who Killed the Ancient Kushite Empire by Drusilla Dungy Houston. Mm-hmm. George Wells Parker, Children of the Sun.
Okay.
Those are probably my 2 favorite books.
Okay. What book has had the most impact on your life?
Probably the autobiography of Malcolm X. Yeah. Without question.
Okay. Where's the best place to get crabs in Baltimore? I'm asking for a friend.
I go to a place called Captain Dan's, which is in Arbutus, Maryland.
Okay. Captain
but
Dan's.
But I season them myself, so you know what I mean?
What
you get live crabs and you season yourself. That's a whole nother show. We have to do another show on that one.
Okay. Do they do crab cakes there, too?
I don't do crab cakes well, unfortunately.
Okay.
I would never eat my crab cake.
What about their place? Do they have crab cakes?
They do.
Okay.
But everything is seasonal around crabs. You know that, right? So you don't eat crabs now. You have to wait until the season is in, especially if you want a Maryland crab. You're only going to get them, let's say, early probably early June to late September, early October.
Oh,
other than that, leave them alone because they're no good.
Okay.
Did I answer that okay?
You did. And more.
Don't you want to know what my favorite cookbook is?
No.
I can't get that in.
Okay, what's your favorite cookbook?
Cooking for the Champ. Cooking for the Champ. It's by Jones Macmillan Publishing. It was done in 1970, and it focuses on it's Lana Shabazz, who cooked for Muhammad Ali. Mm-hmm. It has the best bean pie recipe that you could ever have, and the best carrot cake recipe. All the recipes are very good. And guess what, Boomy? We're going to republish that book.
Oh, okay.
We're going to republish it. Yeah, it's a great book. I love it, love it, love it.
Cooking for the Champ.
Yep, I talked to the authors and publishers yesterday, and we're going to republish it. Cooking for the Champ, Muhammad Ali. If if you go out and try to get it now, it's about $600 or $700. If you wait until we do it, it'll probably be about $20-$25.
Okay.
Okay.
What historical figure would you have liked to meet?
I think, there's so many of them, but the person who comes to mind is Drusilla Dungy Houston.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to get Drusilla. We may not have time for all of this, but Drusilla becomes the first woman, first black woman, period, that does a multi-volume history on Africans in the ancient world. Get that.
Mm-hmm.
This is like she's writing in 1926, and she's collecting information on blacks in the Mediterranean world, ancient blacks in America, and ancient blacks in the Kushite world. This is a black woman writing in Oklahoma. I can close on this point if you let this one get in. This is a woman who in 1921 wrote when the Tulsa bombing happened. This is what she wrote. She said, "I thanked God that day that he had never given me a son. Because if he had given me a son, I would have sent him out to die that day."
Mm.
That's what's happening, Boomy.
I have one more question.
Oh, okay.
What inspires you?
I think what really inspires me and sustains me is reading the words of elders like that, people who have come before me, people who have left the message for me and the mission for me to continue their work, to make them known. Like the idea that I could repeat that for you, which she quoted almost 100 years ago, is tremendously inspiring. That I could repeat the name of Penelope Bullock, my mentors, Dr. Eleanor Sinet, my mentors, women, black women.
Mm.
That inspires me. And discovering and rediscovering and making known books that the elders have written before me, yeah, that makes me get up in the morning.
Mm. Thank you, thank you, thank you for joining me today. So much information that you shared. You've given me a lot of things to think about.
Good.
Definitely.
Good. I know you're thinking about that file. You said, well, I'm just a librarian. Why would they keep a file on me? Yeah, they kept files on all kinds of libraries because you deal with information. You deal with information.
Hmm.
And you have the ability to influence people's lives.
Hmm.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks again.
This
has been an episode of DCPL's All Things Local on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Please visit dclibrary.org to learn more about the library's services and programs. Talk to us online at DCPL on Twitter and at DC Public Library on Instagram. Listen and download the show wherever you listen to your podcasts by searching for Full Service Radio. Thank you for listening.